So I am going to record today's lecture. You probably know there are a bunch of students out for COVID, so hopefully this will help. If you want to hear the lecture a second time, feel free to download the audio and follow along. Obviously, it's not as great as a video, but making a video is surprising, like where you can actually see the board and the slides is surprisingly hard, so I'm just not going to try, to be honest with you. The audio is actually like better in many ways. So here's what we're going to do. We're going to pick up where we left off last class, talking about NIM and doing some live coding. But there's a couple things I want to revisit, and I want to go into a little more depth about classes and objects today. So we're going to talk about a few things. The first thing is I want to give you a study tip. So this is something I'm going to do kind of every Friday as a study tip. And some of these things you might already know them. If you're already like a pro at studying, great. But if you don't know these tips, they can be helpful. And sometimes I'm just going to give you sort of a new way of thinking about something. So we're going to talk about, as we do our live coding today, exceptions, which you might not have heard of before, or maybe yesterday you encountered them for the first time. How do we deal with exceptions the right way? And then, like I said, I'm going to try to revisit classes and objects in some level. Okay, so here's the first thing, study tip. Have you ever thought, I'm just not good at this, right? I'm sure if you're like me, you've had this thought before. Okay. So here's something I want you to know. Really, with enough motivation and attention to something, you can learn it. Obviously, it's not the same for everybody. For some people, it tends to be a little bit easier to learn things than other things. And we can talk about why that is the case later, but I just want you to know that you really can learn anything that you want. And if you're in this class, my job is to make sure that I've cleared all the obstacles that I can to make sure that you learn the material that you're here to learn, okay? And in fact, I want to just point out that you are learning whether you want to or not, just by virtue of being a living being, a living human being. And I'm going to demonstrate this to you. So I'm going to give you some proof. So let me just turn up the audio here. So I want you to listen to this, right? And we're just going to do a little demonstration. Okay, so sounds a little whatever that is. It's kind of a strange garbled sound, right? Let's listen to it again. Let me try this over. Okay. Can anybody make any sense of that? Yeah, what do you think?
That's a terrible idea.
Stop. Okay. But there's something else you didn't get, right? Okay, so maybe we'll listen to the whole thing. One more time. Okay, you heard terrible idea. Well done picking that up. So here's what it is ungarbled.
I think Brexit is a really terrible idea.
Okay, so that's interesting, right? But watch what happens when I play this again, the garbled one.
I think Brexit is a really terrible idea.
Okay, so now that you have heard it once, ungarbled, you hear it now, okay? So, by the way, I didn't come up with this demonstration. This is something that was, so there's this wonderful neuroscientist, I'm going to kind of let him talk about this in a second. But the thing you need to know is that you have a machine in your head, right? I think you should think about it as a machine. And effective learning really boils down to knowing how to use this machine the right way, okay? So let me just let this person explain it. His name is Anil Seth. In case this is interesting to you or you're curious, you should watch his TED Talk. It is amazing. But here's what he says about this.
Okay, so what's going on here is the remarkable thing is the sensory information coming into the brain hasn't changed at all. All that's changed is your brain's best guess of the causes of that sensory information, and that changes what you consciously hear.
Okay, so if you're wondering why it is that some people can learn things faster than others, the short answer is they've already learned certain things that have primed their brain to learn those new things, okay? So there's kind of a snowball effect to learning things, and that is true in computer science. So when in this course, the reason why it matters to pay attention to the little things kind of early on is that understanding those things, kind of ingraining them in your brain, means that when you encounter ideas that build on them later, it colors your perception of those new ideas, okay? That's what we mean by a snowball effect, okay? So now, I think all of you can learn what's in this course. If I were not an optimist, I don't think I could be a professor, honestly. But I also have a lot of evidence, right? I have taught this course numerous times, right? I think this might be my fifth or sixth time teaching this course, right? And I've taught other courses in the department. And I've seen every single class come through and learn these things. So it would be really weird if you couldn't, okay? So I just wanted to sort of prime your brain to think about it this way. You're all capable of doing this. And in fact, you can't even stop yourself from doing this if you try, okay? All right, so, and just, I want to point out, how long did it take for your brain to rewire itself so that you could hear that thing? It was not long, right? Okay, so, some to-dos coming up. Just remember, we have a lab that's due on Tuesday. We have a quiz on Friday. The quiz is now posted, so feel free to take a look. Let me just point out that you are welcome to use your computer, like your compiler, to do the quiz. In fact, I encourage you to do that. It's a good practice. And then the reading that's due on Monday is already posted on the course website. Okay. So, and then just one announcement. Some of you are asking me about colloquium today. Here's our colloquium speaker. I've been talking about this all week, so I'm not going to go into any more detail. But if you're interested in machine learning, this might be a good talk to go to. Okay. So we're going to return to our discussion of NIM. And just recall what the rules are. I don't think I need to go over this too much because we've been talking about it all week. Last player to remove the last object loses. And before we do that, before I actually sit down and start writing code some more, I just want to talk about one way of thinking about a class, okay? I want to give you an intuition. So what is a class, right? I know we write something that looks like this, right? And somewhere, in order to get one of these things, we have to write something like this. And I'm going to let May laugh about this again. Nim, nim, new, nim, right? But what I'm saying here is I want to get another, I want to create one of these from this template, right? A class is like a template, and I want to store it in this variable. What is actually happening here, though? A class can be thought of as a kind of box, okay? Just like all variables can be thought of as a kind of box, right? So if I say int x and I put 1 in that box, it's literally like I've done something like this, okay? Somewhere in the computer's memory, there is a location, and I put 1 in it, right? Same story if I do something like, char y equals a. There's a box somewhere, and I put a inside of it, okay? And what makes these boxes sort of special is that this box is called x, this box is called y. So what happens here, right, when I'm asking for a nim? Well, I just told you variables are like boxes. On some level, right? This box happens to be a nim, which is a class. So it's a box. Now, classes are special boxes because they can store not just a single value inside of them, but multiple values, okay? And that's kind of the point of classes, is that they're a thing that lets you group things together, okay? Now, in this class, I haven't put anything in here yet. So if I ask for one of these, I more or less get something like this. Just a box that's empty. But I can put things inside of it, right? So imagine I had written something like this. And I'll show you something kind of crazy in a second, but let's just leave it like this. What actually happens? Well, it's just like the story I have here, except that it's now inside of this. Okay? Does that make sense? Now, I'll show you the sure. So here's the first interesting thing. When I'm talking about what I want to be in the class, I don't actually have to say what the value is. These are simple values, so I can actually put them just like this inside of my class, right at the top of the class definition. If you had the lab with me yesterday, notice I discouraged you from doing this. And there is a reason for that, and that's because I want you to think about declaring what's inside the box separately from saying how to set it up. So in fact, one of the things I prefer is writing it like this. And the reason is, maybe we'll want to do something complicated when we set up what's inside that box. One of the complicated things we might want to do, just like when we're setting up NIM, is we might want to, say, call some random function or something like that. So inside of a class, we often also have this thing called a constructor. Okay? And a constructor is just a function that says how to initialize the class. If you're familiar with Python, this is just called init, right? Same idea. And when you call this right here, right, when you're saying new nim, you're actually calling this function. So whatever arguments you have in the argument list for the down here, those are the same arguments you have here. Okay? So here I can now say, for example, A has value 1, B has value 2, and the setup and initialization now happen these two steps. First, we create a box. The box is empty. And then the constructor runs, and it fills in what's inside of there. And having these in two separate pieces allows us to do very complicated things if we want to inside of this function. Okay? Now notice, this does sort of look like a function, right? It has a name. It has a parameter list. What it doesn't have is a return type. And the reason for that is it only ever returns one thing. That one thing is whatever class it's creating, okay? Whatever class it's instantiating is the word, okay? Everybody clear about what this means? Yeah?
Can you override a constructor?
No, you can't override a constructor.
Okay.
Yep, you can only have one constructor. Well, okay, let me back this up. You can have multiple constructors, but you cannot have one and then provide another definition of one. And overriding the real benefit of doing something like overriding is when you're talking about inheritance, which we haven't talked about yet. But there's no constructor inheritance in Java. Okay, we'll talk about that in more detail when we talk about inheritance. Yeah. No question. Yeah, Jamie.
You said you can't have multiple constructors, so you can overlook it, right?
No, the converse. You can have multiple constructors. Uh-huh. But you cannot override constructors. Yeah, we'll talk about what overriding means. If overriding sounds like a foreign word to you, don't worry. We haven't talked about it yet. Okay, let me just show you one kind of wacky thing. And this is useful. We will actually use this. I can put anything I want inside of this class, right? For example, pretend I had written something here. What does that mean, right? What it means is, inside of this box, I have another box. That box is a nim that I called n, right here, inside of this. And you might be thinking, this is sort of like, you know, recording a video of yourself, right, like that recurses, like, you know, infinitely. Yes, that's actually exactly what this means. It's like that. And so we actually often do use infinite data structures to represent something. You'll see, our first data structure we're going to talk about is an infinitely recurring data structure. Yeah?
Why did you not say nim n equals new nim?
Where, here?
What you just wrote.
What I just wrote. Well, here, so first, you can only put simple statements when you're declaring what you want. And so one of the complicated things that you might want to do is new. New is actually, generally speaking, we think of it as too complicated to put in the declaration. So you have to put it in the constructor. So we really, if we want to initialize it, we should probably do it here. Okay, now I'm just going to point out this is not a good idea for this particular assignment. Okay, don't do that. We don't need that in this lab. I'm just pointing out you can do that. So you can put anything you want inside of a class, actually, okay? All right, good. So I just wanted to give you that intuition. Just think of a class as a box, okay? For now. Classes are actually much more than that. They can be quite sophisticated devices. That's why we We use them to build data structures because they're very, very flexible. Okay, so let me just give you a sense of how I organize my classes, because one of the things you might have noticed is you can sort of write things inside of a class in almost any order that you want, right? It doesn't actually care that you put the main method at the top or at the bottom. I like to follow a convention, and the reason for that is over the years of writing code, sometimes I go back to code I wrote maybe a couple days ago or a couple weeks ago or a couple months ago, and I just forgot where things were. So the convention I follow, I'll just kind of show you so it makes it easy for me to find things. And you know, when you're learning how to code, it's kind of good to just follow a convention so that it's, you know, you're kind of not wasting your time looking for things. You just know where they are. So here I have a class, let's call it foo. And the very first thing I'm going to put in this class are the things, what we call instance variables. Instance variables are the things that we store inside of the class, inside of the box. Okay? I put those at the top. The next thing I do is I put the constructor, right? And so this is nice because when you look at a class definition that's organized this way, you see the things that are being stored inside of the class, and then you see the constructor. And maybe there's more than one constructor, but you can see them right there at the top. It says, here's what's stored inside of this class, here's how you make one, okay? The next thing I put on are instance methods. Now these are the kind of the main body of the class. This says what the class does, okay? And then the last thing I put in are static methods. So static methods we'll talk about in a little more detail, but a good example of a static method is main, public static void main. So anything that has that static keyword, I put that at the bottom. Okay? Yes, Jamie.
Is class variables synonymous with instance
variables? Yeah, class variables and instance variables are the same. Sometimes people also call them fields. Just so you know, the terminology has never really settled down on any particular thing. In Java, we call them instance methods. In the Java specification, they call them instance methods. So I'll use that term. Okay. Questions about this? Just kind of organization. Yeah.
Exactly. What are the instance methods?
Instance methods are the ones that, think about it this way, methods that can only run once you actually have a box with things inside of it. Okay. So a good example is in the NIM code that we're working on now, let's say take a turn, right, or change player or something like that. You can't do those until you actually have a box that stores like a player variable or something about the board, right? It doesn't make sense to call those things before you have some variables representing that data. And so anything that has that property, right, that relies on the data is an instance method. Yeah?
Could you clarify what the constructor is for? Does that mean?
Constructors are, again, just for initializing a class,
okay.
Right? So when you call new, it's going to create the box. It's going to put the variables inside of it. But we also want to set their values, initialize them.
Okay.
That's what constructors are for. Okay, good. Great. So let's go back to this problem. Oh, yeah, Jonathan.
So with the NIMLab, I was confused about like the get resource and set resource.
Sure.
Like, what do we mean by resource?
Yeah, okay. So in that particular one, the reason why we use this very generic term resource is because, I don't know if you noticed this, but the interface is about not NIM at all. It's about two-player games, right? And so two-player games have some thing, right? Let's call them piles of matches, right, in the case of NIM. But it could be like a deck of cards. It could be a stack of coins. It could be poker chips, right? All these things. And so the two-player game interface doesn't say anything particular about any kind of resource. It just says your game has some resource. It's up to you to decide what it is. And so I think in the case of NIM, the way we want to think about it is a resource is a pile of matches. Does that make sense? Okay, good. Yeah, May.
Following that logic, why couldn't you just index instead of calling get resource?
Ah, well, notice that in an interface, it doesn't say anything about how you actually store things. It just says what the interface is, right? So there's this distinction between the way you actually organize things inside of this box. What if I don't want to use an array? I don't have to use an array, right? Depending on the game, I might not have to use an array at all. So the interface doesn't force you to use an array. When you're talking about indexing, you're talking about using an array. So that's why it doesn't say anything about indexing. because it might not have any relevance to the game, the two-player game you happen to be implementing. Now, NIM does actually have something that lends itself well to an array. That's why we use it. But the interface doesn't say anything about it. It's very general.
So why, is it possible to do NIM without using...
Oh, yeah. In fact, the... So not without get resources and set resources. You have to use those. But I'll just point out, when I implemented NIM, I used a data structure that you'll learn at the very end of the class, because I wanted to explore different designs. I used something called a hash table, right? So I didn't use an array at all. And it's fine. You can actually do that. And partly I did this to just make sure that our interface made sense. It was kind of robust to different ways of organizing things. Good. Good question. Okay. So... let's talk about initializing the board randomly. So I think a lot of you actually got to this yesterday, but let's just quickly go over it in case you didn't quite get that far. So I'm just going to fill in the current player because we, in fact, this was a little bit of a mistake, right? So where we left off the other day was that we had a board. Some of you call this piles, some of you call it board, it kind of doesn't really matter. We had a current player. We decided in our constructor that we wanted to create a board, right? So we are now initializing, right? We're creating the actual array of size num piles, storing it in that board variable, okay? And then inside here, what we decided we wanted to do was to randomly select the number of matches for each pile. And we have some constraints. We have some minimum number of matches, and we have some maximum number of matches, right? So one of the things we have to do is we have to set up a random number generator. And hopefully one of the things you discovered was that you have to import a library to do that. So that library is called Java util random. Now, Java has this really wonderful and large library of functions that you can use. It's called the standard library. Random is part of the Java standard library, okay? And if you want to find documentation on it, the thing that you do is you go to Google. Oops, sorry, that's games. Google. And you type in something like Java doc, Java util random, and you're always allowed to use Java docs in this class. One thing I'll just point out is as we start working with data structures in this class, we actually have our own set of little data structures we'd like you to use that are not a part of the standard library, and they have their own documentation. I'll show you that once we start working with it. The reason for that is if you've ever looked at a Java doc, they're kind of big and complicated, right? Because these are like industrial strength data structures often used, really everywhere. So like, by the way, most of Google runs on top of Java. And so they tend to have a lot of sophisticated features. And so when you're learning data structures, it's nice to have something that's maybe a little bit simpler. So we have a set of data structures for you to kind of get started on. After you're done with this course, go to town. Use the ones that are in the Java standard library. Okay, so the first thing we want to look for is a function in here that will let us sample a number, okay, some kind of integer. And what we really want is something that lets us sample a number between min matches and max matches. If you look at the documentation here, there's only two functions. There's one that gives us just any old random number, and then there's one that lets us go between zero and a bound. Now, a few of you actually have a much newer version of Java that actually does exactly what we want, right? Where it lets us set a minimum bound and a maximum bound. But it turns out you can translate this one into what we actually want. And let me just give you the intuition for this. So let's suppose for a moment we want to sample a number between 3 and 7, let's say inclusive, right? We want 3 to be a possibility, and we want 7 to be a possibility. How many numbers are in here? How many numbers are possible? Anyone? Yeah?
5.
Let's count them. So 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, right? How would you compute that? Well, I mean, before you get that far, how did you figure out there was 5?
Oh, you counted them.
You actually counted them. Is there a faster way, Emily? You were raising your hand. 7 minus 3. And that's not quite right. We're close. +1, right? Because we want it to be inclusive. But that's the idea, right? So this is a little bit faster than actually counting them, right? So what's the formula that Emily used?
Max
minus min plus 1. Okay, great. So this is interesting, right? Because, so we're going to get five numbers here now. And if we decide we want to sample between 0 and this number, then we're going to get a number, and this is, remember how this function works, it's exclusive. But we're still okay, because there's five numbers between 0 and whatever this is, right? So in this case, it'll be 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, five numbers, okay? So we can do that. We can call now, was it next int? And we can say, give me something here, but this is, we're close, right? But we're not quite there yet. What's the last thing I need to do? Yeah, Zach.
Plus min matches.
Plus min. And why is that?
Because otherwise you just get 0. If you add min, then you get the, you're like shifting your range.
Right, we're shifting the whole range over, right? So this is kind of the formula that you can use in general to make that random number generator do what you want. Now, if you happen to have the one that has the upper and lower bound, you can use that one too. But this is a useful technique because often we find ourselves in situations like this where the method that we have to use is not quite what we want to be able to use. And so you kind of think about, how can I make it do what I want? Okay, so let's put this one in. Yeah, Sanyukta?
Could you do max plus 1 and then outside of the function minus 3?
You could, it's a good question. Your range would be too big. And if it, let's say it picked 0, right? Because 0 is a possibility. And then you subtracted, you said min. Now you get a negative number. Just not quite what we want either. Right, so, okay. So let's just fill this in. So first thing I need to do is initialize a random number generator. So I'm going to say random r equals new random, okay? And then we're going to use it here, and we're going to use that exact formula that I did before. So r, next int, we're going to say max matches minus min matches plus 1, and then minus min matches. There we go. And that should let us, that should give us the number that we want. Okay. Oh, sorry. Plus, yeah, thank you. Thank you. Plus. Did I write plus up there? I did. Okay, thanks. Yes, plus max, plus min matches. Okay, good. So I think the next step that is useful to do, you know, once you have an initializer, is to spend a little time thinking about how to print something out, right? How to print out what you just did to verify that it actually did the right thing. Now, I think all of you had a pretty good handle on how to do that, so I'm not going to spend time talking about that now, but if this is where you are and this was helpful to you, that should be your next step. Go ahead and make it so you can print out the board. Okay, so what I do want to spend some time on, though, is kind of the next maybe not super obvious thing, which is how do we actually read in some inputs in this program with like something like scanner. So let me just make sure that my code compiles. And here's a little tip I strongly suggest that you use, which is don't try to code up the whole program and then compile it. You'll have the experience that I think many students had yesterday, which is, here's 100 errors, right? And it's much easier to just do tiny things and compile them. So notice, all I did in this little class exercise was I added some random number generation. I think this would be a good time now to recompile. So let's see if I got things right. I might actually have gotten them wrong, in which case we can fix them together. Oh, look, I did actually make a mistake. Turns out I forgot to put a semicolon up here. So, excellent. All right, good. Great. And one of the reasons I'm showing you this is, you know, I make mistakes all the time, right? And so this is a trick that I use to just make it so that I can manage my own mistakes. Yeah?
I believe the start.java is different than nim.java, right?
Ah, okay. Good question. Why did I use star.java instead of nim.java? Okay. Some of this is a little bit of a habit on my part, but one of the reasons I do it is I'm also lazy. I don't really want to type a lot of stuff, but one of the things I want to do is I want to make sure that all of my Java code is compiled, okay? And so suppose I went and changed toplayergame.java and I forgot to compile it. Well, that would matter for nim.java because the interface that it's using actually changed. Now, in this class, this particular assignment, that's hopefully not happening because you're not changing that. But why did I do it? Well, I just don't really want to think about which files in this directory I need to compile. So what this says, star means everything. So this expression here means everything that ends in .java, just compile it. So this is the same thing as writing nim.java, toplayergame.java, has the same effect. But notice how much like how much less typing it is. I can just type in star.java and it compiles everything in the directory. Does that make sense? Okay, good question. All right, so let's talk about Scanner. So Scanner is a library for reading input, okay? And we gave you a handout, and I think I posted the handout to the course website. Let me just verify that it's there so I can show you. And we'll kind of refer to it. Let's see, 136 handouts. Okay, I haven't put it there yet, so let me just open it. I think this should be it. And we gave you this yesterday in class. So the reason why we gave you this handout was because this has a Java doc, but the Java doc is actually a little too much information, right? It's a little hard to figure out like how to use this simply. But here's the basic idea. It's a utility that makes it easy to read in some data and convert it into the form that you want it to be, right? So as you all know, when you type in a string, it's a string, right? But we might want it to be a number inside of our program, so how do we change it? One of the utilities we've talked about before was value of. There's another one called parseInt, right? These are utilities that will do the conversion, but you have to remember where to find each of those conversion utilities for each of the types you might care about. Scanner makes it a little bit easier for you because it's just one tool that can do all the conversions you might be interested in, right? So you can look at here and see we can convert Booleans, ints, longs, doubles. There's actually a ton more that's not shown here. And so we just want you to get used to using Scanner because it's a useful tool. Okay, so let's start writing our code using Scanner. So just like we did with random, we have to import the library. This one happens to be in Java util. And by the way, notice how it underlined this in it. And it kind of grayed out. The reason for that is I haven't used it yet. And it's just the editor is letting me know, hey, you have this import you haven't used. So nothing's like wrong here. Let's initialize our scanner. Now, let me ask you this. Are we going to use the scanner once, or are we going to use it multiple times?
Multiple
times. So do you think there would be any value in maybe just setting it up once so that we don't have to keep setting it up? Yeah, there is. So I'm going to suggest for just the moment that we put our scanner inside of our class, right? It's inside of our box because this box is going to live for the entire duration of the game, right? And then we can set up a scanner and use it over and over again. So let's do that. Let's create a scanner. I'll call it S. And I'm actually going to put it right here inside of this box. In fact, this is just going to be the first thing I do when I set this up. I don't know why my indentation is kind of messed up here, but okay. So init scanner. So what do? I call it S. I type a new scanner. Now, there's something that you have to put inside of here. We can't leave it like this. Hang on one sec. You have to say what scanner is going to read from. Now, there's a variety of sources of input, right? We could type things on the keyboard. Another source of input is we could read a file. There's actually tons of sources of input on a computer. I think we want to do the keyboard, and so what we're going to use is something called system.in. System.in is called standard input. Standard input is the keyboard. Yeah?
Why would you want to do that or make the scanner the main method? Because what if you wanted to, like...
Oh, like great question.
Algorithmically, like, play NIM?
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
You didn't want
to,
like...
That's a good design question. If I wanted to... So you're talking about, like, what if I wanted the user to tell me what these values are, right? Wouldn't I have to ask them, and wouldn't I have to have scanner down here? Great question. The answer is yes. So then... what we would do is we put a scanner here. Now, by the way, there's no harm in setting up scanner twice, right? What I would like to avoid is setting up scanner, let's say this n turns, n times. So, and by the way, just so you know, for most computer scientists, we'll talk about asymptotic analysis soon, but there's not much of a difference between 1 and 2. There's definitely a difference between 1 and n, or 2 and n, right? Yeah, Jamie.
Do you have to close the scanner after you use it?
Ah, okay. So technically, yes. Okay, so Jamie's asking this question about closing a scanner. Let me ask you, why are you asking that question?
My previous professor told me to do it with
C++. Yeah, okay. So a different programming language had a different scanner, and you had to close it. And I'll point out, if we go to the scanner class, the Java doc, this is one of the details that we hid from you. If you look at, so scanner implements an interface, and that interface is called closable. So you might think, yes, I should close that. I just want to point out, in Java, if you close the scanner, very strange and unpredictable things happen. So the way it's supposed to work is you're supposed to close scanner at the end of the program and not before. But also, here's another interface that it implements, which is called auto-closable, meaning it closes itself and you don't have to do it yourself.
Yay.
So good question. Don't worry about it for this one. There will be resources in the future that you do have to close, but let's hang off. Let's talk about those for now. Good question, though. Okay, so we have this scanner now, and since it's inside of my class, I should be able to use it anywhere I want, right? When I'm doing something. So let's see, do I have a take a turn method? So if we go back to our main method, and I kind of commented this out, I had this thing about is game over, take a turn. Let's quickly go to the is game over method. So by the way, here's one of the reasons it's kind of nice to use in IDE. Like specialized code editor, I can go click on this. So I right click and go to definition, and it just jumps right to it. Right? I don't have to search for it, which is kind of nice. Right now, it's by default, it says the game is always over. Let's change it so the game is never over. That way, just so that we can like tinker with this a little bit. Okay, that way I can start up the game will play until I force it to quit. Okay, that way I can actually try writing a take a turn method. So we don't have one of those yet, so let's write one. So public. What should take a turn return? What do you think? Any thoughts?
Nothing.
You don't really need it to do anything except to change its own internal state. And the way that we asked for it down here, we didn't give it any arguments, so it's a method that takes nothing and returns nothing. It's just going to update the game, but what it is going to take in some input, but it's going to take an input directly from the user, from the keyboard. Okay? So let's do that. Scanner. So, first we have to tell the user what we want from them, right? So, print. Let's say, and in fact, I'm not going to do print line because that's going to put in a new line. I'm just going to just say regular print. Please enter a number. And now we're going to use the scanner to read that number in. And we're going to say next int. And what should we do with that number? Let's say for the moment, we're just going to do something simple. So this isn't really what we want to do ultimately. But I'm going to put this in our board at, let's say, index 0. I just want to store this someplace, okay? And here's what I'll do just to demonstrate that this did the right thing. Let me print out what's at board 0 before and after. And by the way, writing code that will not ultimately be in your project, but will help you write your project, is a good skill to have. Remember, you're not committed to any code that you write. I don't know if you've ever seen somebody do woodworking, but they often build tools to build tools, and then they use these tools they built, and then at the end they throw them away, right? And you're like, why did they build all this stuff that was never part of the final project? Because it's what it like helps them build things. So we have a similar thing here in computer science. We often build a little scaffolding to help us do our development. Did it do the right thing? So right now we have a program that hopefully will create a new NIM board, and while the game is not over, it will prompt us to read some input. We can type it in, and hopefully it'll tell us what we typed in correctly. So let's try this. Okay, great. No bugs, no compilation errors. So notice it printed out what was in there. We set up our board randomly, so it just happens to have 1 right now. Let's say I type in 8. Now you can see that 8 is in there, and we're looping it back around again, so it said 8's in there. What if I type in 0? Good, this is great, right? It's sort of doing what I want. And I can even type in long numbers, and those also work. Watch what happens when I type in something it doesn't expect, though. Right, that's kind of bad. So how do we deal with this? This is the next thing I want to talk about, which is something called an exception, okay? So here's a little definition slide for you about exceptions. So I'll just give you a minute to write this down. But an exception, a software exception, is a mechanism for signaling errors. Exceptions are the way that they appear. We use this word thrown. Sometimes we use the word raised. But when an exception is thrown in a program, the program will stop running. This is often what we mean when we say the program crashes, that an exception happened. And unless the program specifically is looking to catch that error, to handle that error in some way, the program will crash and terminate, right? Stop running, okay? So exceptions, and by the way, exceptions are a good thing, right? It's telling you that something weird happened. In our case, right, I typed in hi when I was expecting a number. The program doesn't know what to do about that. So it says, okay, I'm just going to stop working. We'll talk more about how exceptions work in the future, particularly how they relate to what's called the call stack. But we're going to kind of postpone that for now. But just so you know, understanding exactly how to handle exceptions in the kind of the most effective way depends on some level understanding what the data structure is that the computer uses in order to make them work in the first place. Okay, so I'll just kind of defer that for now. Okay, so, yeah.
How is using exceptions rather than just running a validation check?
Writing a what?
Then just running a validation check.
A validation check. Well, this is how a validation check would work. So, Scanner is actually doing the validation for you on some level. You said, I expect an int didn't happen. Please handle this now. Okay. Right? So this is actually how we signal that things went wrong in general. So you can think of it as Scanner is the validator, and this is just how it signals that something went wrong. Okay, good. I'll just say that the alternative is to sit down and write something called a parser. Parsers are a lot of work, honestly. And the fact that it's all packaged inside of Scanner is really useful for us. Okay, so how do we handle this exception? Well, the question is, where do we want to handle it? Let's handle it right here. And the way that you do that is you write something called try. So what we want to do is we want to take this and try it, okay? If everything goes fine, this will just run as usual. But if something goes wrong, this little section down here, which is called catch, is going to run. Now you have to say what to catch. And if we look down here, we can see that this specific exception that it raised was something called an input mismatch exception. But it turns out that we can also just put something very general down here. We can say, if you get any exception, because it could be other kinds of exceptions that happen, please let me know. And so what will happen is, if nextInt throws an exception, then we have the opportunity to handle it here without the program crashing, okay? Anybody want to suggest what we might do?
Ask them to re-input.
Yeah, ask them to do it again, right? So maybe we do something like this. We say...
an error message.
Yeah, an error message. What do you suggest putting in here, Hod?
Invalid input.
Invalid input, yeah. Or maybe even, we can even be more specific, not an integer. Try again, right? Something like that. Now, we already have a method specifically for taking turns. I could somehow reorganize this, maybe using a loop so that it loops, and that's probably a good idea. But here's another idea, by the way, that we could do. So I'm only going to print this out when it's successful, okay? But here's something we could do. Just call that method again, right? Notice it doesn't return anything, so it's sort of okay to call it again. And at the end, right, so suppose that first one gets called, it fails for some reason, it calls itself again. It doesn't have to do anything after it returns, so this is sort of okay. So I'm just giving you a little hint, this is recursion. We're gonna use recursion a lot in the future, but here's a good use of recursion. So let's try this, let's see if it does what we want. Okay, so first, let's just make sure the ordinary case works. 4 is already in there. If I put in 5, 5's in there. Put in 7, great. Seems to be working fine. If I type in hi, uh-oh. Okay. Small problem, which was that the scanner actually was sort of not ready for something, right? And it attempted to continuously read the thing that we wanted, which means that we have to do a little bit of kind of resetting work to make sure that the scanner doesn't keep trying to read that bad thing over and over and over again. So let's go and look at our handout and see what it suggests doing. Does it actually say in here? I don't think it actually says in here, which is kind of a bummer. Okay. So one of the things that we can do to prevent this from happening is, so you can reset it, but there's another way of working with it, and this is the way I want to show you, which is first you can ask if there actually is an int before you try to read it, okay? If there isn't an int, we can warn the user early, and then we can try to read it again once they've entered in a second time, okay? So I'm just going to leave it at this for now because I want to switch over to objects. But think about this, and I'll just point out that if you want to try some of the other methods that Scanner has in terms of resetting and all that sort of thing, you can go and look in here, and the documentation for how to do the kind of resetting or how to try another one, it's all in this documentation here, okay? So let's switch over to...
Would you put hasNext in? Or is that
you would try hasNext first.
Okay.
Okay. And then you, if the answer was true, then you would read it.
So you don't, if you use that, you don't want me to try anymore?
No, that's a good question, actually. I think you still want the try. No, actually, you can get away with not having the try. That's right. If you try it that way. Yeah, that's a good point. Okay, so let's back up and talk in our last couple of minutes about classes and objects one more time. And I want to just introduce this idea. We'll revisit this, but I think this is important for you to know. Okay, so remember I said classes are like blueprints or prototypes, okay? So imagine we're designing a class for a triangle, okay? When we instantiate a class, we call it an object. And that's a copy of the class, right? Remember, a blueprint says how to make a house. A class for a triangle says how to make a triangle, okay? So, for example, we can have like a medium-sized green triangle and a big red triangle and kind of a small orange triangle. These are all triangles. They all were kind of copied from this original one here, but they are different in certain details, okay? Great. Let me just give you another example just to kind of reinforce this. A car is a prototype also, right? We have this kind of, let's think of it as a platonic notion of a car, right? Plato used horses, I think, in his analogy. Right? So there are many cars, obviously. You can recognize them when they drive down the street. And they all kind of have different shapes, and they all look a little bit different. They all have the same interface, though. And the interface is designated in the class, right? It says what is common to all the cars. Okay, for example, wheels, doors, steering wheels, so on and so forth. Okay. The thing is, these cars do vary. And if we are trying to represent them somehow in a computer, how do we represent the details that vary? Well, if we go back to our model of thinking about classes, or really objects, as boxes that store things, the details that differ are going to be the things that are inside the box. Okay? So, okay, going back to this question about what are methods, right? Well, methods are functions that are tied to either objects or classes. What do I mean by that? So, if you have the keyword static, like main, public static void main, that's something that is tied to the class, not the object. Otherwise, you have something that's tied to the object. Let me just be really clear. Let's go back to this example, this kind of platonic example of triangles. Suppose I have two methods, and I want to attach them to either the class or the object. Which one should go where? Where should numSides go? Is it attached to the object or is it attached to the class? The class. Why do you think that?
I think it's like fixed because it's a triangle.
Yeah, it's fixed. This is true of every single triangle. How about area?
It can vary, like if we're going
to... Can vary. So yeah, so that's exactly right. We want to attach numSides to the class. We want to make it static. We want to attach area to the object because it varies. Okay? Let's do cars. One more and then we can all go. How about can roll? What do you think, Jamie? The class, because all cars roll, kind of by definition. Great. How about color? What do you think, Jamie? Right, because cars can have different colors. Okay, great. That's all we're going to cover for today. If you run into problems with scanner, we'll talk about it some more on Monday.